I'm June Wandry, born June 25th, 1920, in Wautoma, Wisconsin. It was a beautiful town surrounded by lakes, trout streams, and friendly retired folk. Population, 1,000. I started school when I was 4. Mother read to my 2 older sisters, younger brother, and I every night. She had attended a 1-room country school, a 2-mile walk from her home, and she thought education was the most important thing in life. Her handwriting was exquisite. My father was 49 years old when I was born, the 3rd girl in a family that was desperate to have a son. Dad attended school for only 2 years, but was tutored at night by the school teacher who boarded with his family. Both parents were avid readers, excellent mathematicians, something that I missed inheriting from them. My first grade teacher had pugs of hair all around her head, and I often thought it kept her brain too hot, as it matched her temper. She thought I was much too chatty, and for punishment would seat me on a trough-like bench seat with the village's only retarded girl woman, who was about 20 years old and was still not housebroken. I was mortified to have her wet my pants. The punishment didn't cure me from being chatty nor make me love the old teacher. I grew up during the Depression, and we had all sorts of food, wild meat, plus beef, pork, lamb, chicken, and fish of all kinds, wild berries and tame berries. Mother had a garden that covered 2 house lots, and we grew most all of our food and preserved it for the winter months, like eggs in water glass, potatoes, squash packed in dried leaves, celery planted in a bin in the basement, mushrooms, morel mushrooms, put down in a salt brine in a 20-gallon crock. All of our toys were made by my father, who was an accomplished woodworker. I had a wonderful, happy childhood, many loving relatives who were quite old. We'd have marvelous frequent family reunions at different lakes near my home. Mother wouldn't let Dad smoke in the house nor around us children. She said we had to protect the babies. We went to the Methodist church almost every Sunday in Wautoma, and other Sundays we would go to a German Methodist church in the country where the men and boys sat on one side and the women and girls sat on the other. The sermon was in German, which we did not understand. My Wandry great-grandparents came to America from the German part of what is now Poland in 1852. Grandpa Wandry gave acres of land across the street from his farmhouse for a school and church. German-American children in those days were taught to be self-sufficient at a very early age in about absolutely everything. I'd go hunting with my dad for squirrels and rabbits, and he taught me how to skin and clean what I had killed. When I was 7 and wanted some spending money, I started a bait business, and I sold angleworms for 5 cents a dozen, but not on Sundays. That was for my mother. And I sold these to the city slickers from Chicago and Milwaukee who came down to the lakes for the weekend. They always gave me a 50-cent tip, which was half a day's wages for a man at that time. They'd never seen a skinny, green-eyed girl rummaging around in a bucket of worms before. I banked most of my money, and when the banks failed in the Depression, I got my first lesson in high finance and got back a penny on a dollar. I learned about crooked bankers and greedy politicians. At the age of 8, I attended all political meetings with my father, despite the thick cigar smoke. There, I learned a lot and always got A's in civics, geography, and history. The principal of our grade in high school was George Eber Dafoe, the cousin of Dr. Dafoe who delivered the Dione quintuplets, and he kept them alive in the kitchen oven in lieu of an incubator. Mr. Dafoe was also the father of Dr. William Dafoe, graduate of the U of Wisconsin and Harvard Medical School. Bill is the father of Willem Dafoe, a current movie star. Dafoe had respect and perfect discipline in the school system, which made our school a great place to learn. Study hall was pin drop quiet at all times. When I was in sixth grade, I learned to type after 4 p.m. Our teacher stayed until 6 p.m. every day, and my wonderful Latin teacher, Miss Bernice Olson, she was also the librarian, made school so exciting. She said Latin was fun, and it was. We had Roman dinners and would dress in robes and lounge on benches to eat our Roman food. After school let out at 4 p.m., I'd retire to the library and read the encyclopedias and do part of my homework so that I didn't have so many books to carry home. Both parents were home every night to answer our questions and help us with our lessons. I always wanted to go to college, as Madison was such a beautiful place, and I wanted to be a doctor because my mother always fell apart in an emergency involving one of us children. Then I'd take over. My high school graduation speech was titled, "For Value Received, I Promise to Pay." I won a scholarship to the University of Wisconsin, but it only paid my tuition of $25 a semester, nothing for books or living expenses. And Mother had decided that I was to become a medical missionary, and if I did not do that, she would not pay my way to college. I didn't want to be a medical missionary. So I saved my bait money, my babysitting money, and worked in the grocery part of the big department store on Saturdays. I started at 6 a.m. and was given time to run home 5 blocks to eat my lunch. Then I worked until midnight and was paid $1. We employees kept our bodies going on eating the delicious boiled ham during the long hours that we had to spend there. In our spare time, Bill Dafoe, Howard Fergut, and I ran an ice cream parlor for an out-of-town owner. We affectionately called it the Slop Shop. This shop was in an old abandoned post office building, bare floors, bare walls, tiny sink in the bathroom, park-like benches along the walls. A milkshake cost 10 cents. You filled the mixer almost full of ice cream, added a tiny glass of milk, a glop of thick chocolate sauce, and a tad of malt. And if you could turn the container over and shake it once and nothing fell out, that was a perfect milkshake. It was so thick you had to have a strong metal spoon to eat it with. We three old friends all went into the medical profession as our life's work. Just turned 17 and still sweet 16 at heart, I sold my hockey stick, baseball mitts, bats, flexible flyer sled, and skis so that I'd have money for books. My dad, on the sly, bought me a two-piece wool suit at Jameson's store, plus two white blouses. The skirt was black wool with tiny wisps of Angora woven into it. The jacket was woven out of red, white, and black wool in a tiny pattern with a slim patent leather belt. For footwear, I had a neat pair of buckskin boots made with patent leather, trim around the top, and a pair of Russell moccasins from Berlin, Wisconsin. That was my total wardrobe for the university. I left Wautoma forever. Mr. Dafoe didn't own a car, but he had got someone to take us to Madison to talk to Dr. Frank about me, as it was a few days past registration time. We went to the student placement office where I was assigned to a lawyer's family composed of two preteen, spoiled, plump, lazy children, a pregnant older wife, and Mr. Lawyer himself. There I was supposed to work 21 hours a week for my room and board. However, these people were tyrants. They had me rise at 6 a.m., dust down the open stairway, bristle the carpets, prepare and serve their breakfast as if it were the Ritz-Carlton. Do the laundry, iron everything, including his daily white shirts. I had over a mile to walk to classes, and I was carrying 16 credits in pre-nursing. They never let me have time to study until after 10 p.m. I had no money to spend on long-distance calls to contact my family. The only person that I could confide in was my chemistry professor, Ernest Hesse. I was the only girl in his class, and every week he would rotate me between two different fellows, as he said, to share the wealth. I had not had high school chemistry, and all the fellows had. Hesse would tutor me at any time I had a problem with a class. He also fed many of us students by taking us out to dinner at a little restaurant a block from the campus that served shrimp. I was a skinny kid to start with, but with the regime I had at the lawyer's work farm, I became skin and bones, and my hands looked like they belonged to a longshoreman within a few weeks. Once an old friend of mine from home rang the doorbell and asked for me, but the Scrooge family I lived with would not let me see him, even for a minute. And then came my night of absolute horror. It was about 1 a.m., and I had finally finished my studying and started out the door to the bathroom when I spied the very, very naked lawyer heading in my direction. My piercing scream could have been heard by Oscar Rennebaum at any of his pharmacies. Early the following morning, I called my father on their phone. He came and begged me to come home, as the people in town were talking about his daughter had to work her way through college and he was getting embarrassed. I told him no. He'd just find me another place to stay. I'd do very well. The university assigned me to a wonderful family. The father owned a large automotive business. His wife was a lawyer, and they were an older couple and wanted a sister for their 12-year-old, very shy son. For housework, I had to dust the downstairs on Saturdays. The husband washed supper dishes, and I dried them. My new mother did my laundry and apologized for asking me to iron my own things. When I first arrived at the university, we were given a skin TB test, and I was terrified of what the results might be, and I sat up all night watching my arm to see if the injection site would enlarge. And because I was so thin as a child, my mother would always say to me, "My dear, you must have consumption." But then she never took me to the doctor to see if I really did have it or not, and I'd been scared for years. The terrifying test was negative, and I ran all the way to my classes the next day to prove that my lungs were okay. Wisconsin was a free thinker's paradise. Students from out east flooded our campus. They were so worldly and arrogant and tried to make us from the small towns feel inferior. The Cardinal, the Capital Times, and the Wisconsin State Journal titillated its readers every day. The lawyers and engineering students were always feuding, and in one of their feuds, an engineer had his shirt yanked off, and then someone threw him on the sidewalk and another fellow sat on his chest. A third student grabbed his feet and pulled him along the sidewalk until his back was a bloody mess. My social activity revolved around Wesley Foundation, playing tennis, going to dynamite parties, picnics, and playing games. It was a good Christian environment. One of the fellows who also frequented Wesley was a top track star, and he was so very shy, and for entertainment, we'd all go out and watch him practice. I attended French movies, hoping to learn the language better. I met a member of the crew from a small town up north, and we played tennis frequently. We hung around the crew house and talked about Wayne King, who spent his summers in Arnold's hometown. The day they permitted women to go into the Rathskeller, I was the first person to put out my toe into the room. As my mother was the president of the WCTU, I didn't go in any further. For my Phi Ed class, I chose bowling. I'd never bowled in my life because the alleys were always in saloons. The teacher explained the rules the first day and said that the score was 300. I followed teacher's instructions to throw the ball down the line of arrows. I had 79 in the third frame when she tore into me at the top of her voice, asking how I had the nerve to even come to that class and have 79 in the third frame. I told her I was sorry, but that I'd never bowled before and hoped that I would get closer to 300 by the time I had finished. My final score was 179. Only then did I notice that other people's scores were 25, and there was one poor soul, had only three. Bill Dafoe and John Beck, both University of Wisconsin and Harvard Medical School grads, and I would hitchhike home some weekends. It was illegal to hitchhike using your thumb, but you could just stand there, and if someone offered you a ride, that was not illegal. The fellows would put me out on the edge of the road as bait, and they'd sit in the ditches or hide behind a big tree until a car stopped for me. Then they'd come bounding out. One time, the lieutenant governor of Wisconsin stopped to pick me up in his big, black, chauffeur-driven limousine. He was just starting to lecture me about the dangers of hitchhiking alone when the fellows came out of the ditch. He took me right to the door of my house in Wautoma and introduced himself to my mother and said, "Mrs. Wandry, here is your daughter, safe and sound." Between classes one day on Bascom Hill, while I was admiring old Abe, I saw Basil Busaka, who was someone I had met when I was 12 and he was 14. We both went to a church camp in Lamira, Wisconsin, and I had never seen him since. He lived in an apartment house with football players right off campus. They had a fireplace and some rather neat but run-down furniture. Apparently, they were given their books and all sorts of other goodies by the university athletic department. And at the end of a term, they would have a party, invite me to come over, and they lit the fire in the fireplace and they fed it with the pages torn one by one from the books that they had just finished using. Basil eventually got his PhD and taught at the University of Wisconsin for many years. In 1937, there was only one male black student in my Bascom Hall lecture series. He sat in the back row by the doorway on the aisle. I always said good morning to him when I came in and he'd smile. I never saw anyone else speak to him. I had an ancient history professor who had written the text that we had to use. He was a wizened little creature with a very thick accent, even though he'd been in America for decades. History had been one of my loves, and he bored his students to death. There was also a white-haired lady English professor on campus. She dressed in purple from nose to toes. She'd saunter regally across the campus as though it was her personal possession, dispensing patented smiles along the way. My wonderful French professor, Monsieur Stanovich, taught me French with a Polish accent. He had a smile that went ear to ear and the most sparkling, twinkling eyes. In the summer of 1938, I became old enough to enter the Kaler School of Nursing in Rochester, Minnesota. They offered room, board, work unlimited, and one half a day off each week, and 1 week's vacation each year. If you were ill while a student, you had to make up your sick time after you graduated. My commuting distances for the Kaler School of Nursing classes, there would be only 1 to 2 blocks compared to the mile I was doing in Madison. Besides our own Kaler School of Nursing staff, we had access to the 700 specialists at the Mayo Clinic as our instructors. Patients came from all over the world. Diseases and conditions that could not be solved anyplace else came to Mayo's. Each day was an incredible experience. As part of our training, we had a choice to go to the University of Chicago or the University of Minnesota to affiliate for pediatrics and obstetrics. And I chose the University of Chicago and Children's Memorial Hospital, which course took 8 months. There was some weird law in Minnesota that said you could not go out of the state for over 6 months without a penalty. And so when you graduated from the Kaler School of Nursing, you had to work free for that 2 extra months that you'd spend in Chicago. And I graduated December 1st, 1941. On December 7th, 1941, my life and health changed forever as the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Dr. Mayo had organized a general hospital on paper which I joined, as did many people from the clinic and the nursing school. You had to be 22 years old to be in the Army Nurse Corps, and I was only 21. The Mayo unit did not activate for many, many months, so I joined the Army Nurse Corps in October 1942 at Fort Custer, Michigan. And on my record, it said I was attached to the Mayo unit, and if and when they activated, I would be released to them. Our troops landed in Fidela November 8th in the invasion of North Africa, and wounded were streaming back all over. Field hospitals were needed with surgical nurses, and I volunteered to go for the duration. I wasn't given a furlough to visit my parents, and within days I was on my way overseas with people I'd never met before. No Army training and no proper clothing. We were a field hospital, the first hospital behind the battle lines. I have 8 major battle stars. We were split into platoons of 6 nurses each and a few enlisted men and a few medical doctors. Each platoon was sent to care for an infantry division that was fighting in the line. And when we needed surgeons, we'd call for the surgical auxiliary teams to come. That way, we were spread all across the front and rarely ever saw our other platoons. We went in the invasion of Sicily, our men went in on D-Day, and we went in on D-2. And when that fighting ended, we crossed the Straits of Messina into Italy and went all through those campaigns, Cassino, the Anzio beachhead. And then our men went in the invasion of southern France on D-Day, and we went on D-4, all through France, crossed the Rhine in the dark of the night into Germany. We retreated Christmas Eve in the Battle of the Bulge, and when the war ended, we were with the 45th Infantry Division that liberated the Dachau concentration camp and Alak displaced persons camp that was 5 kilometers outside of München, or Munich to you. Many times during the war, I worked 15, 20, and 24 hours a day. When we were sick, there was no one to replace us, so we kept on duty. War is hell. Men get us into war. It solves nothing. It kills our finest and healthiest young men. And those who aren't killed are maimed for a life of daily suffering. My self-published book, Bedpan Commando, The Unedited Story of My Life as a Combat Nurse During World War II, tells it all. Combat soldiers say, June, there's no bullshit in your book. And I didn't know until 1985 that my mother, who died in the 60s, had saved all of my letters and photographs. I never asked anyone to look at my manuscript. I knew that if anyone read it, they would laugh and cry and have trouble putting it down. But I did send a letter in 1985 to David Ballantine of the Bantam Books, the military editor, and asked if there was an opportunity at that time for a book by an honest-to-God combat nurse of World War II vintage. By return hate mail, he informed me in his misspelled letter that a nurse's book would not be high on their list of printing priorities because it would be sophomoric, boring, and of interest to only a very, very few people. Well, women have been belittled and put down since the beginning of time, and the war didn't change that a bit. The only things I'm afraid of are snakes. When I landed in USA in late October 45, I was hospitalized in 3 Army hospitals in Wisconsin and Illinois and discharged in July of 1946. Then I went merrily back to the University of Wisconsin campus on the GI Bill in the fall of 1946. Registration is something I will never forget. The place was jammed with soldiers in uniforms. The lines were long. The staff of young females spent their time fawning over all those male hormones. Just because a soldier was in uniform didn't mean he had ever left the States, and if he had, it didn't mean he had been in combat. There's a mighty big difference between the rear areas and the front lines. When I asked at registration for admission, I was told in the snidest of tones by a young female that they were only accepting Wisconsin residents. And I said, I am a Wisconsin resident. She sniffed, really, and said, we're only accepting Wisconsin veterans. I said, I am a Wisconsin veteran, and I want a private room on the first floor in a dormitory. Very smugly, she sniffed again and said, we are only accepting women who were former students. I said, I am a former student. Her looks were enough to kill, as some waiting combat GIs who had witnessed and heard the whole episode gave her the raspberry. Well, off I went to my first class in creative writing. I was the only woman. The rest were stateside GIs in their uniforms minus their PFC stripes. I wrote about the war. Miss Instructor, daughter of an Ivy League professor, said I couldn't write creatively and gave me a C before she dashed off to Japan to become a Quaker missionary. I worked part-time in pediatrics at Wisconsin General, but the pay was only $1 an hour. It didn't cover the cost of my laundry of my uniforms. The library paid 60 cents an hour, and I decided to go and work there. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I learned many fascinating things, such as chickens can have chicken pox. Then my roommate and I took anthropology that summer session from a visiting professor from the Southeastern University. We just loved the class. There were very few females in the group, mostly males. And Helen and I both got perfect scores in all of our projects and papers and the final exam. And His Highness, Dr. Male Chauvinist, gave each of us a B double plus. I'd never heard of one before. But he said we couldn't get an A, but it's strange how the men got A's. We didn't. There were, let's see, I auditioned for the Women's University Choir and was accepted. As it's nearly 50 years ago, I recall only that it was a pleasant experience. And we did perform frequently. We had an excellent male director. I believe that his name was Mr. Jones. Porter Butts ran the Memorial Union with great flair, and I worked with Ann Foote making displays for the huge bulletin boards at the Union. Ann and I made contact with each other several years before she died. And one year, I was in charge of decorating areas of the Union for Christmas. In some place in the dark recesses of my home, there are perhaps some snapshots of the wonderful displays we used to do. Well, back to the war for a minute. After the war ended in Europe, the government opened Shrivenham, an American university. I believe it was in Swindon, England. And all of the faculty came from leading universities in USA, and my journalism professor was from the University of Wisconsin. So naturally, I decided when I got back to Madison to build on that phase of my life, and I took journalism. Again, I was the only woman in the class. We had to subscribe to and read each day 7 different top newspapers. We got tested frequently on the paper's contents. I carried 16 credits, which included assorted other classes. The instructor was a Navy veteran who must have even hated his mother. He looked totally bored with his classes and gave all of the plum assignments to Navy male veterans. And one of my humorous but very dull assignment was to cover the president's wife's tea. I appeared at the appointed time my professor had given me. No one was there. I rang the bell. Mrs. Fred shouted from the second floor, "Come on in, come on upstairs, please help me." There she was, almost pretzel-shaped. She was tangled up in the long back zipper on her dress. It was caught in her hair and everything else. There was a veterans group on campus that wrangled frequently and met rather regularly. And as I was the only woman in it, I was uncomfortable and quit attending. There was a blind, red-headed psychology instructor and her dog who brought color to the campus. Barnard Hall had an interesting mix of students, and two of my favorites were black. One was Mary Burke, the head of WGA, a top student, a super bridge player, a dear friend. Our dorm had a formal dance, and where I don't recall, but it was someplace over near the football field, someplace. And it was too far away to walk, and Mary was freckle-faced, auburn-haired, slender, beautiful, brilliant person. Her date was a darker-skinned young man. We were going to double date with them for the party. The cab driver refused to let them get in the cab with us, no matter what I said. My gut hurt. Then I had also signed up for creative design, even though I was not an art major and the teacher didn't care for people who were not art majors. Some of the male students were going to be architects, and Irvin Kenny, a young black veteran, was very, very talented. He never got a decent grade on anything in that class. None of the male students ever sat next to him. So I did. We had a very complicated assignment this one day, and I walked over to his men's dorm and met him in the lobby, where he corrected my sketch, and we walked to our class together along the Lake Mendota path. Sad day. My beau was a World War II veteran in pre-law, and we had our activity tickets together. And that night at the basketball game, he changed seats with someone five rows over from me and never spoke to me again. The racist rabble-rousers were only too happy to spread misery from one dorm to another. One summer school session was spent living in the men's dorms. The food was fantastic. We could have seconds. I couldn't believe it. We paid the same mess bill as at the women's dorms, but we're always hungry. Soon after we moved in, we were plagued with a window peeper. And the house mother came to get me, and I was supposed to confront him because I was a combat nurse, while she called Joe Hammersley. I finally caught him behind a small shrub and asked for his identification. He was an instructor on campus. They sent him to the state hospital across from Lake Mendota for a permanent residency. There was a similar episode at Barnard Hall that winter, and I saw his footsteps in the snow outside of my window. The house mother locked all the doors but the back one, and she held it slightly open with her foot, so if I had to run, I could get inside. But I frightened him so much that when I asked his name, he actually gave it to me. I threatened him with expulsion and disgrace, and brought up Mahatma Gandhi's name and Nate Mazumdar. I think this fellow flew back to India the next day. Maybe he's still wondering who that 5'2" person was. In 1937, I had met Nate Mazumdar at Wesley Foundation. He had come to visit his brother who was a student on campus, And Nate told us that he was Mahatma Gandhi's private physician, so I thought I was really dropping a powerful name. For campus characters, there was Joe Hammersley, and then Harry Stuhlreiter, the coach, Crazy Legs Hirsch, Howie Weiss, handsome football player, and Dr. Carl Paul Link, one of my husband's grad school professors in biochemistry. Link constantly fought with the athletic department by shouting out of the windows at the lab. He also hated the wrestling team. One year he wrote my husband a Christmas letter the year after he'd graduated, and it was addressed to Dr. Axley Rexley. I said, "My, your professor really knew your name." Then Dr. Kiekhofer, my dear old economics professor, who always got a boom, ah, greeting as he flipped those long shreds of hanging hair back onto his bald spot. I had another econ professor, I don't recall his name, who spent all of his time working on the Government Labor Relations Board and settling strikes. Well, it was just as well that he was gone, as no one could understand him anyway, his accent was so thick. What saved us were the quiz instructors. I want to read a poem to you that condenses the war for me. No one has done it better than did Private David C. Ferguson, who wrote a poem in the Stars and Stripes that's called Listen, Mister. And I want to read it to you because, you see, every time we ever got a paper overseas, everybody was striking at home. We were dying, and they were striking for higher pay. Listen, Mister, by David C. Ferguson, 30th Infantry Regiment of the 3rd Infantry Division. So you're tired of working, Mister, and you think you'll rest a bit. You've been working pretty steady, and you're getting sick of it. You think the war is ending? You're slowing down the pace. That's what you think, Mister, but you bet it ain't the case. What would you think, sir, if we quit now because we're tired too? We're flesh and blood and human, and we're just as tired as you. Did you ever dig a foxhole and climb down deep inside and wish it went to China so you'd have some place to hide? While buzzards with motors in them circle overhead and fill the ground around you with hot exploding lead? And did you ever dig out, Mister, from debris, rock, and dirt and feel yourself all over to find out where you were hurt and find you couldn't move, though you weren't hurt at all? You feel so darn relieved that you sit there and bawl. Were you ever hungry, Mister? Not the kind that food soon gluts, but a gnawing, cutting hunger that bites into your guts. It's a homesick hunger, Mister, and it digs around inside. It's got you in its clutches, and there ain't no place to hide. Were you ever dirty, Mister? Not the wilting collar kind, but the oozy, slimy, messy dirt, or the gritty kind that grinds. Did you ever mind the heat, sir? Not just the kind that makes sweat run, but the kind that drives you crazy till you even curse the sun. Were you ever weary, Mister? I mean, dog-tired, you know, when your feet ain't got no feeling and your legs don't want to go. But you keep them going, Mister, you can bet your life we do. And let me tell you, Mister, we expect the same of you.